To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show, or to let us know you'd like to work with us on it, or to have us spell out that long web address for you. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info at 430-9722. That's 430-WSCA. Now we hear an interview of Megan Mattson from the Leave My Child Alone campaign about military recruitment in schools. This is produced by Housatonic Radio Works.
LeaveMyChildAlone.org, a request and a World Wide Web address combined. Megan Mattson is a mom working with Main Street Moms to get the word out about rights parents of high school-aged kids have to withhold personal information from the Department of Defense and local military recruiters. An obscure section of the No Child Left Behind Education Act requires school districts to supply personal information on students to local recruiters and the department to aid in their respective recruitment efforts. The same section also has provisions for parents to notify the school district and the government of their desire to opt out of this data-sharing process. Folks at the Leave My Child Alone initiative are finding that some school districts are not readily supplying this information to parents and have launched a campaign to alert parents to this year's deadline, which falls in October.
We really launched pretty much just before the military stand down day for recruiters in May, and since that time have been working to put together resources for parents around the country to help spread the word on opting out of the No Child Left Behind military recruitment section in the schools. And then we have a big push in September, the launching September 7th through the 30th, and we have parents signed up to go, committed to go to their school board meetings with resolutions protecting family privacy and suggestions for their districts on how best to inform and empower students and families in opting out of those lists.
So the list itself, you mentioned No Child Left Behind. It's tied to that legislation?
It is. No Child Left Behind passed in 2001, and there's a section called Section 9528 that was sort of tapped in there by a Louisiana Republican who wrote language that forces high schools to turn over student information to military recruiters or risk losing their federal funding. And actually some districts have been threatened with the loss of their federal funds when they have tried to follow their own student privacy protection policies. So it's an interesting little piece that not many people knew about.
And the information then is fed both to the local recruiters, but isn't there also a national database that they're looking at?
There is, and we actually just set it up so you can automatically opt out of both databases through our website. The Pentagon database includes information on 30 million 16 to 25-year-olds, and it's collected from a range of sources, so it includes some very sensitive information like Social Security numbers, email addresses in some cases, and then some weird stuff like height and weight, areas of study. So it's a pretty intrusive collection of data. And our feeling is that they've been collecting this information for about 3 years, and they only announced that fact in June. And there's a Federal Privacy Act that requires any agency to announce it when they start collecting a new batch of information on American citizens. So they really put off that notification.
So they didn't actually publish the notice in the Federal Register until very recently, then.
Yeah, in June. In the first article I saw on this, it said that they realized they had forgotten to notify a year ago, and then apparently notified in June.
Yeah, it's typically that's not something that's a big forget.
That's a pretty big forget. We think it's pretty big. Yeah.
The opt-out provisions, that is that actually in No Child Left Behind, or is that?
It is. In Section 9528, it says high schools must turn over this information to military recruiters. Districts must notify families that this is happening. Families have the right to opt out in writing. So there are those requirements. It's just that implementation of it has been all over the map. So some districts might have a little paragraph about it in the back of the student handbook. Some don't have any mention of it, and then others do a very good job with a standalone opt-out form and a letter home. And so we're just trying to really bring all the districts up to a higher standard on notification.
Right, and you have to, and it's an opt-out for both the local recruiters and Pentagon, but that those are separate forms, right?
They're separate forms, and you have to opt out of both because the school level No Child Left Behind requirement is strictly local, and then the Pentagon database is the federal, and it's used more. I was told by the Department of Defense that it's used by the four branches more for things like direct mail and that sort of thing. And they say it's updated daily and sent out monthly.
Okay. And then the you also have, looking at your website, I noticed Adopt the School Board program. Do you want to talk a little bit more about how that is working?
Yeah, that's actually our big push in September, since the opt-out deadlines are generally in October for the schools. We're really encouraging people to, as I said, go to their school board meetings with we have good sample opt-out forms, and then we have a resolution that we encourage people to get their local school boards to adopt. And so that's really that program. We've done a lot of letter writing to local school boards and people writing the letters enclose the resolution and ask school districts to practice optimum opt-out, the basics of which are a standalone opt-out form required as part of registration. I mean, the return of which is required as part of registration, translated into applicable languages. So really the Adopt a School Board program is that if we can get even one school board member to really take this on as a privacy issue, you can achieve kind of a turnaround in opt-out rates.
Okay. And if somebody listening to this is interested in getting more information, where can they go?
They can go, if they go straight to leavemychildalone.org, it's a great place to opt out of both databases, Pentagon and No Child Left Behind. We would love to have anyone listening come to the website and find out how to plan a school board outing this fall. We're also encouraging people to just print up lots of opt-out forms and have them around, especially in districts that aren't providing them easily for students. I don't know, it's been a fun thing to work on just because it comes as a real surprise to people, and it's an obvious
wrong.
for many to have. The school districts that hope to opt out as a district or received, some of them received letters that were co-signed by the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Education. And just a lot of people feel that this has nothing to do with learning and just doesn't belong in the No Child Left Behind Act, and they take action
right.
as a result.
Okay.
There's also, I'm sure you see this on the website, but there's an opportunity to co-sponsor as a citizen the Student Privacy Protection Act, which would close this loophole and require written consent before any information is released rather than...
sort of positive concurrence rather than negative concurrence.
Very well said. Thank you.
And they can go to the website to do that? Okay.
Uh-huh.
And that website is, again?
LeaveMyChildAlone.org.
Okay. www.leavemychildalone.org. Thank you very much for your time, Meg. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Megan Mattson spoke to us from the offices of Working Assets, an activist phone company based in San Francisco. Phone calls placed to local school districts were not returned in time for this broadcast. You are listening to Locally Grown.
That was Megan Mattson from the Leave My Child Alone campaign, interviewed by Housatonic Radio Works. You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. We now go to an interview with Mike Vivas, done by Making Waves interviewer Damon Thomas. They're going to discuss the right-wing assault on education in the United States.
Good afternoon and welcome to another interview segment here on Making Waves. I'm Damon Thomas. I'll be your host for the next several minutes as we explore an issue that affects us all very deeply, particularly public school students and parents of those students. My guest today on Making Waves is Michael Vivas, an author and retired educator, and today's segment promises to be an exciting and engaging one as we explore the crisis of public education and the ongoing and widespread drive to further regiment our young people. Michael is 50 years old and has spent 21 years as a public school teacher with nearly 17 years in Lowell, Massachusetts. Simultaneously, he and his wife, Mary Ann Dunsford, a psychiatric therapist, moonlighted as owners of Pear Tree Lane Stable, an equestrian academy in Haverhill. Michael finally retired from teaching not so much because of the work of owning nearly 70 horses in the past 20 years, but because, he says, quote, "the right-wing assault on public education fed me up. I figured I could only help change the system by removing myself from it. One cannot change a bad system by being part of it." And I've quoted Michael there. Michael, thank you for appearing today on Making Waves, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Damon.
I'd like to introduce the topic of public education. We know that public education is in crisis today. In this state, in this region, throughout the country, everywhere from crumbling buildings to regimented curricula, public education is facing an onslaught, arguably, that it has not faced perhaps ever or in decades. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. You do have, as I said, you've been introduced in your role as a retired educator, and I'm wondering if you could provide some initial insights into that proposition.
Well, there's so much to say about it and the problems that I see in public education. We could be here for a very long time. I think the first place to start might be with this notion of regimentation. For most of my time as a teacher, I fought against what I saw as regimenting kids in schools, from lining them up to total obedience, to lack of creative thinking, to lack of teaching critical thinking skills. I saw children, and as they moved through middle school and then became young adults, that the primary goal, it seemed, of the public schools was to regiment kids. Obedience was paramount. Following a set curriculum for the teachers was paramount. The idea of creating individuals who were able to think abstractly, using analysis and synthesis, was not as important as making sure that your kids got to school on time, followed the rules, and the parents stayed away from the school. Sad to say, that was what I experienced. I also saw teachers unable to think critically as well as teach critical thinking skills to students. The activities that they presented did not give kids enough experience and analysis. Young people did not were not given activities whereby they could pull together various points of view to come to a better understanding of a problem. Skills of empathy were lacking in the public schools. Skills of association were lacking in the skill in the schools. Children cannot associate one problem to another. They cannot come up with solutions to complex issues. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be a priority to teach those kinds of things in the schools. Which brings me to the notion of standardized testing. One of the reasons I became totally disillusioned with public education was the drive toward one size fits all. And that's the notion of standardized testing. It has basically swept the country. And I think the reason it swept the country has to do with its simplicity. Now, in order to reach a large segment of our population, it's very important that things be presented in a simple manner. We have a president who's excellent at that. Whether or not George Bush himself is a simpleton is up for debate, but he sure presents things to the population in simple black and white terms. And this is appealing, and it's easy for people to understand. Now, standardized testing fits in very well with that. In fact, Texas was a leader in standardized testing. And as I've said, it's swept the country. Most of the states now have some sort of standardized test that is a high-stakes test that is the determining factor in some cases of whether a teacher is able to retain his job in the classroom, whether or not a student will progress to the next class, or in extreme cases, whether a school can be shut down. I know here in Massachusetts that it is possible for a school to be shut down if after a number of years the school is identified as a, quote, a failing school. Now, the problem with that is that it doesn't take into account the myriad of factors affecting certain schools. For example, a school that I taught in was in the center of Lowell, Massachusetts for a number of years. Nearly 90% of the students were on a free or a reduced lunch and breakfast. This meant they were below the poverty level. Over half of the population had a single parent at home. There were very few positive male role models. In fact, in the school, I think there were approximately 50 staff, and there was a male principal and me. We were the two men in the school. I think there was a male gym teacher, and that fit the stereotype of the male being the gym teacher. So I used to think, well, kids aren't experienced seeing positive male role models even in their schooling. But anyway, when you look at the makeup of the school that I was teaching in at the time, is it any wonder that it was a failing school? Parents of these kids did not have a positive outlook about education themselves or a positive experience when they went to school. They didn't feel comfortable coming to the school. They did not provide simple things like a homework space for their children when they came home after school. Many of these kids might come home to an empty home or possibly a grandparent at home who might have been a little elderly and unable to care for them properly or watch them properly. Now, with those kinds of impediments facing these children, is it any wonder that the school was a failing school? The school cannot pick up everything that it's expected to do and then present all these kids with a high-stakes test and base all of their learning on that test, and also base the whether or not the school is succeeding or if the child is succeeding. We forget that there are many, many ways to measure what a child is learning. I think today, Damon, one of the big problems in education is that we determine an individual's intellectual ability by the degree to which it can answer a lot of facts. I want to call it the bright student speaks in Jeopardy-like fashion. And if he can memorize a lot of facts and spit them back, then that student is intelligent. I think that's kind of false.
I wanted to explore that subject of standardized testing versus what I might call a critical thinking analysis, where we're training our children to perform to a particular level on a given standardized test. Can you describe briefly what standardized testing involves and how the notion of standardized testing conflicts with our idea of developing a curriculum that allows a child to fully develop his or her abilities and to develop into a more critical thinker, which is what's necessary to maintain whatever remnants we have of a democracy here in America today. Obviously, well-educated citizenry is necessary to implement a viable working democracy. And in the absence of analysis, debate, and discussion, which is what's needed among the citizens, without that, does not the larger society begin to collapse in terms of a democratic model? So I'd like to, if you could just explore the issues of standardized testing, what it involves, and how it conflicts, if that's your proposition, how it conflicts with the idea of a free and open society, ultimately.
Well, let's see where we begin with that. Standardized testing does conflict with the notion of a democratic society because it doesn't take into account the many variables that you're going to see in America. We are a country of so much variability, and when we try to structure it into a one-way street, it's just not going to work. And there's a great effort going on. It's not going on. I think it has succeeded to create this one-way street in America. Is there any hope for it to change? I don't think so until we get this right-wing government in Washington out of power. Until that happens, we're going to continue to go down this one-way street. Let me talk a little bit more about how standardization or standardized testing conflicts with building the kinds of values that we seem to talk about and hear about in America. We're hearing a lot today about freedom, liberty, and democracy. He changes the words every so often to democracy, liberty, and freedom, and then we hear it liberty, freedom, and democracy, and this is coming from George Bush. Now, for a man who talks democracy, freedom, and liberty so much, I wish that we could see that kind of stuff going on in our schools. Again, we don't. I used to spend a great deal of my time trying to build the kinds of thinking skills with youngsters that conflicted with the notion of standardized testing. Now, let me give you an example. One of the activities I would spend a lot of time on was called contract building. I would try to build a community classroom, a sense of a classroom where we had certain goals we wanted to meet. We had certain propositions we needed to fulfill. And I would ask the kids, well, how are we going to do this? And the students would build the contract with me. They would tell me, well, this is how we're going to get to the goal. This is what we're going to do. And if we can't meet the goal, this is how we'll change it, because things might not work out the way we planned, and we'll have to have some plans to meet the failing plan that didn't work. So what we're going to be doing is changing our contract from time to time to meet the needs of the classroom. And I would try to build in them a sense of the classroom was like a town, a city, a state, a country. And we would not have in the classroom a hierarchical system. There would not be a classroom president. There would not be a classroom representative. But we were all sitting as part of a very large group, all trying to come together on with the idea of what is it we wanted to accomplish in that classroom. And some of the standard things kids would say would be, well, we want to learn. And I would always ask the students, well, what is it you want to learn? Well, isn't that a novel idea? Very few people say to the kids in public school classrooms, what do you want to learn? And I think that's a very valid thing to ask them. Do they want to learn about American history? Do they want to learn about why we really had a civil war? It wasn't just about slavery. Do they want to learn about who really got us out of the Vietnam War? It wasn't Richard Nixon. It was the peace movement in America. That's what got us out of the Vietnam War. Just as an aside here, we don't even get near the Vietnam War in American history. I think for most kids, American history stops somewhere around the mid-1800s. It's just so expansive to teach a history course. We don't even get near the 20th century. History doesn't stop. And I know, and for most of us, I know when I was in school, my history education stopped somewhere around the late 1800s. Everything after that, I had to learn on my own. We didn't even touch World War II. But standardized testing runs in the face of trying to build an atmosphere in a classroom where you're going to build the kinds of skills where young people are going to have to analyze what it is they're doing, why they're doing it, and what their goals are. Standardized testing asks the teacher to fulfill a certain number of expectations at a certain time, by a certain time, and if those expectations are not fulfilled, then that teacher had better create a plan to fulfill them fast, whatever those goals and expectations are. If you are a math teacher, possibly your goal is that you must teach, your fourth graders must learn geometric figures before March 16th. If they haven't learned geometric figures by March 16th, well, you're behind because the test is coming May 1st. And your goal of teaching them fractions by April 10th had better be fulfilled, and you've got to move on to fractions now. So where does one find time to say to a group of kids, okay, we're going to spend this week discussing the things that we've been talking about that we want to learn and how we're going to learn them this year, what books we're going to read and why we're going to read them and how we're going to read them. When you have to meet, when you are under a constant deadline to meet certain criteria to fulfill a standardized test that has been put forward by, usually by, politicians somewhere in a state house in a capital who've had little experience in a public school classroom, well, you're just setting yourself up for a lot of failure.
These trends that you've described, these trends towards standardization, is there a particular time period that you can identify when these trends began? Has it been a gradual introduction of this sort of thing? And have these trends accelerated in recent years?
I think if we look back to something that happened in California some 25 years ago. California came out with a proposition, and they gave it a number. And the proposition was to cut taxes. We know when we start cutting taxes, the first things that get hit are public services. Now, that idea is wonderful. No one wants to see their tax money improperly used. I know I sure don't. And if I can pay fewer taxes, I sure am happy with that. And we all are. However, when you look at the broader picture, and I loved to do an activity with both children at the elementary level and then young adults and at the high school level, I used to do an activity about taxes. Well, of course, no students want to pay taxes. Well, once you started saying to them, well, if we cut enough taxes, we might not have enough policemen. And then I would talk to them about the fire station closing down their town. Or then I might talk to them about the library being closed in the city. Well, suddenly these children woke up and said, well, wait a minute, we don't want to do that. And I'd say to them, well, where are you going to get your money from to keep these places open? This all often elicited a lot of anger with the students, and it was an activity that I likened to critical thinking skills. If you just tell people, we're going to cut your taxes, and isn't that great? You're going to have plenty of money now to spend any way you want. We've got to educate people to understand that when you cut their taxes, while on itself that seems like a great idea, there is going to be a trade-off. Now, you asked, when did this trend begin? I really believe it began with the first tax reduction proposition that started in California a long time ago. Now, I don't know who was governor at the time in California and put forth these ideas, but I know that Ronald Reagan was governor of California in the 70s, I believe, and he came into office and rode in largely on a pledge of keeping taxes low. This was so appealing to Americans who probably pay one of the lowest tax rates in the world. I can't verify that, but I would venture to say that Americans pay very, very low taxes in comparison to most of the industrialized countries in the world. As this no tax pledge came into our communities, you had school board members, you had mayors, councilors, state representatives, state senators, all adhering to this idea of we won't raise taxes. Along with that seemed to come this idea that standardized testing was the way to go. And it was very appealing. Of course it's appealing. People are always saying, George Bush has said it a number of times, there's only one way to see what a child is learning. You've got to test them. And it is so ludicrous to think that that's the only way someone learns. I used to keep portfolios for my kids. At the beginning of the year, we would create a folder, and we would measure their progress by looking at their work from month to month. They'd stick all their work into the folder, and we would look at the writing. We'd look at the math. We'd look at what it was they were learning and how they were expressing themselves. It was a great technique to use as opposed to a high-stakes test. But something like that takes a lot more work, takes a lot more effort, takes a lot more what I want to call analysis that you don't have to spend time with as much with standardized testing. The standardized testing movement piggybacked on the no tax movement. And as we lost money in the public schools started having more and more problems. Now, if you take money, it's a simple equation. If you keep taking money away from something, it's going to struggle. There's going to be more and more difficulty. If a community here where I live in Haverhill, Massachusetts, if you put us next door to Atkinson, New Hampshire, the schools are startlingly different simply because there's more money per student available. So as we took in the country more money away from the schools, the schools had more failings. This is not brain science. This is very, very easy to understand. You take money away from something, the services have to go down. Class sizes increased. Books became older. Technology did not keep up. I left the last school that I taught in Lowell, Massachusetts. I had one computer in the year 2003. One computer was available to me in the classroom, and it was a Macintosh LC3 computer. I did not have email. I did not have internet hookup. And when I would go to other communities or other parents and tell them that, they'd be alarmed. They'd tell me things like, I email my child's student. And I would laugh and say, huh, I don't even have an adequate computer in my classroom. I have a TV monitor and a VCR that was shared by about 6 or 7 classrooms. Is that any way to provide a quality education? And I was teaching in a multicultural school where kids needed high exposure to technology, high exposure to different ways of doing things, and it just wasn't available.
How has the presence of the increased use, I should say, of
of vouchers to private schools and private institutions, including in some instances religious institutions, affected the funding available for public schools?
Well, once again, the more money that is drained from a system, the less opportunity it's going to have to excel. And if we combine that with having teachers spend most of their time aiming toward the teaching the kids how to succeed in a test, you can possibly do quite well in that school with limited money. Spend lots of your time teaching them how to succeed on the test, and usually after a number of years, 4 or 5 years, once the teachers get skilled at the test themselves, and they can explain to the students throughout the year how to answer certain questions, eventually that school can do quite well. It can show high marks on the tests that are provided at the end of the year. And you can do it reasonably with very little money. In fact, I remember leaving, as I was leaving public education, spending most of my training on how to create activities so that my students could succeed on the tests that they would take each year. In Massachusetts, we call it the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System, I believe. MCAS is what it's known as. And there are many of these kinds of tests in the country. They go by different acronyms. In Florida, it's FCAT, Florida Comprehensive Assessment Testing. Texas, it was TAS, Texas Achievement Something System. You have a number of acronyms they use so that people can remember them. In any event, your question is so simple in its nature, and yet complicated in trying to figure out how do we get out of that problem, the problem of draining money from something and then wondering why it's not doing well. Why isn't the car operating too well? Well, we had to cut back this year on the brake linings. You might notice when you go to stop, you don't stop. Well, why was that? Well, General Motors was having a bad year, and we cut back. Oh, okay, so I'll have to be careful when I put the brakes on. Well, similarly, in public education, the same notion is going to happen. Now, I've talked a lot about money to you, and I do want to talk about the issue of the unions, teacher salaries, and how that has affected money in the country and how that's affected the schools. Let me go on and try and tell you what I have seen happen.
We remind our listeners that you're listening to WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. My guest today is Michael Vivas here on Making Waves. And Michael, you've discussed a number of trends in public education. I am interested in hearing your remarks further on this subject, if you would.
I know, Damon, that I hear continually teacher salaries are too high. Plenty of money is being spent in the public schools. There's been so much talk that the schools have plenty of money. In Massachusetts, there have been millions of dollars under an Educational Reform Act that was passed in the early 90s. And the public looks at that and says, we want results for that money. We're not getting the results. And people will say, well, all that money is going to teacher salaries. All that money is going to the unions. And once again, the teachers' unions become the whipping boy for a failed system. Now, as far as teachers and their salaries, there's no question in my mind that teachers are underpaid. When you put together that there are teachers I know who do not have one but two master's degrees, and there are a number I know who have almost completed a doctorate. I taught in a public school in Lowell where over 50% of the teachers, when I left, had master's degrees. Now, at the time, I think the top pay scale level was $50,000. Now, someone earning minimum wage is going to say, that's a heck of a lot of money. And they're right. But someone working minimum wage might not have spent 4 years in college, 2 years more for a master's degree, and be going back every summer to improve his skills for 3 or 4 weeks by taking some course in a university somewhere. That was my life for a number of years. Eventually, I just parlayed all the credits I kept earning into one degree after the next. So I'm not going to begrudge the salaries that teachers make. Now, whether or not that money is used improperly is debatable. The reason schools are having a difficult time is not because teacher salaries are too high. It's not because teachers are unionized. In fact, one of the great successes of public education in America is that teachers were finally given the kinds of rights they needed to have so that they could teach successfully. If teachers had not become unionized, their salaries would probably be 50% lower than they are today. The ability to negotiate and to make contract is what is probably what's made schools so strong today. One of the things we have to touch upon, and we started to when we talked about the regimentation of schools, something that has bothered me for a long time is a sort of militarization that I see that goes on in the public schools.
I wanted to introduce that topic as well, Michael, because it seemed to me that public schools have in recent years provided a growing forum for military recruiters and military personnel to secure ready access to students. How has the increased presence of the military in the public schools influenced the course of education?
We know that young people are easily influenced. All people are easily influenced. Adults are too. That's kind of comical to say it's just young people. Just look at what Washington, D.C. does if you want to see how easily people are manipulated. I heard a news clip recently that startled me. A school in Londonderry, New Hampshire, an elementary school. Now keep in mind, elementary school goes up to about 11 years old. Had a Black Hawk helicopter touch down in its playground. And the field trip for the day was to have these impressionable 5, 6, and 7-year-olds take a tour of the Black Hawk helicopter. Well, I thought, what better way to glorify our military than to take our littlest kids and give them these awesome military sights, a Black Hawk helicopter, and to have an officer, a uniformed officer there. I thought, wow, is that not the best way to breed a nationalistic instinct and breed patriotism? Take them when they're young. And then I thought, did that ever happen before in our history? I thought it sure did in 1930s Europe. And to do that to our young people struck me as somehow not quite right, that we could spend the day better if we took these 7- and 8-year-olds or 6-year-olds and brought them to somewhere like the Museum of Science, or perhaps brought them to a children's art gallery, or maybe the children's museum. Or maybe we could bring them to an equestrian academy. Maybe we could bring them to a farm. Maybe we could bring them to watch a birthing of a calf somewhere. I thought, how much better would that be than to have these kids tour a Black Hawk helicopter? So I started thinking about, how do we militarize our young? How do we ready them to die if they're needed someday at age 20? How do we militarize them so that their parents will freely give them away to go somewhere like the Mideast, like we are now? How do we do that? Well, first we have to glorify it, and we have to start glorifying it from an early age. We have to start making it look heroic. We have to start convincing the parents of the value of it, and if we can do that sort of thing, then we can have a fertile breeding ground for future soldiers. Now, I often wonder when I hear about the cult of heroism going on with our military today, I start wondering, what has happened to our nurses, our police, our firemen, our detectives, our teachers, our social workers? I wonder how our society would be different if you drove through New Hampshire and saw flags draped over the overpasses that said "Glory to our heroes, our social workers and our teachers." It's odd we don't see that, but we see tons of stuff for our military. Now, that's important too. We need a strong military. There's always someone out there ready to attack the leader, and our country has always been a leader. We saw this in the 1930s. We, in fact, waited far too long to jump into Europe. We should have been on top of the Nazis' case in 1930 when gangs of brown-shirted Nazis led by a charismatic person named Adolf Hitler were going around and staging demonstration and beating people. Well, the United States was pretty passive during that time, and we didn't want anything to do with it. We should have been there long ago. In fact, I think World War II has been the only noble war of the century. Anything after that has been all political. The students in our schools, as they move through elementary school, where we teach them the regimentation they need, where we teach them obedience, as they get to high school, you start seeing the recruiting go on. Now, kids are very easily influenced, as I said before. If you put a spit and polish looking Marine there, and you offer to these youngsters free college education, and you offer them free health care, this is very appealing. Now, what worries me is that we take kids who cannot afford college and say to them, if you go into the military, we'll pay for your education. That sounds like a sort of a bribe to me, and it's very troubling to me that we have to take kids who can't afford things and say to them, well, if you risk your life, then we'll give you something in return. We'll give you lots of money. We'll provide for your education. We'll help you buy a home. Well, what about the kids who can't afford these things? Do they go to West Point, Annapolis, the Citadel? Is that where they go? And the poor kids are the kids who don't have the money. Do they go to Middlesex Community College? Or do they go shuffled into the state college system? You know, something seems to be a little inequitable there. And it seems to me that when recruiting goes on, it's targeting only certain kinds of kids. I will tell you right now, Damon, I don't think there's too many recruiters wandering around Phillips Academy in Andover. And I think that's disgusting.
Mike, do you have any additional comments or remarks as we wrap up today's program that you really want our listeners to take note of? We've discussed a wide range of topics here. People may feel that there's something they can do or something they need to know about. Or if there's a point that you want our listeners to particularly take note of, I invite you to make those comments here.
Every so often, Damon, I read in the paper that a parent has become outraged over something like a Judy Blume novel, because in her novel she has a 14-year-old girl expressing her questions to her mother about her growing into adulthood. This has happened to Judy Blume. And you get a parent who's outraged over something like that, yet that same parent will do nothing when a classroom is turned over to a military recruiter. I think the parents' priorities needs to be looked at. There are a lot of parents listening, I'm sure, today who have got to reorder their priorities and see what's important in their classroom. Is the child bringing books home? Is the child reading? Does the parent have books around their home? Does your child see you reading? If your child doesn't see you reading, if you don't have books around home, if when your child was 4, 5, 6 years old, if you haven't read to your child, then you need to reorder your priorities. Those are some things you can do as a parent. Start talking about college at a young age to your children. Don't start talking to them about going into the military. Talk to them about going to college. That's what we need. We need an educated citizenry. If we are going to be so-called citizen soldiers that I hear about, we better be bright people. We better be educated people. We better know how to reorder a society, how to get a society improved. Right now, that's not happening. We are not hearing about the kinds of things going on in our military that are are the sorts of things we want to have our children be exposed to. Parents can start bring your child on a weekend to a different restaurant. Introduce them to Mideast food. Introduce them to Indian food. Take them to a cultural festival. When there's a field day somewhere at your school, volunteer, join in with the school somehow. If you can't join in with it, send a note in to the teacher, thanking the teacher for it. But if you hear that a Black Hawk helicopter has touched down at your school, your child's school, and you hear that your 7-year-old child spent the day and looked through the Black Hawk helicopter and then went into his classroom and drew the Black Hawk helicopter, then I think you need to get into that school fast, and you need to talk to your principal about what is it your child learning? What is your child doing that day? Your child is only 7 years old. Those are some things a parent can do. Keep in close touch with your school. But at the same token, give your teacher the freedom to teach. And don't be concerned about what the child is reading. Be concerned about the fact of whether or not the child is reading, and how much is the child reading. Is your child reading comic books, or is your child reading nature magazines? Is your child reading video magazines about the latest videos that are coming out? Or is your child being introduced to something as innocuous as The Little Prince, which can be read on a child and an adult level? Is your child spending most of his time preparing for a test that's going to occur sometime in April or May? I know when I left school teaching, we started off the year with the California Achievement Test. That was done at the end of September. And then the rest of the year, we prepared for the Massachusetts Comprehensive Achievement Test. So there was no end of test preparation. Damon, I want to thank you for giving me the time to talk about all this today. It's so expansive, and there's so much to talk about. I do hope parents keep a close watch on what their kids are doing and what their kids are learning in school, and please encourage your children to read. Read as much as they can and about as many different things as they can, as many different subjects as they can. Teach your child another language if you can. There's this great movement in the country about only teaching English. Teach your child to learn another language. Teach your child how to empathize with other people and how they might be feeling. When a child can step in the shoes of somebody else, it's amazing how much they'll learn.
Michael, I want to thank you for your time here today and for our listeners who joined in on this discussion. I hope everybody gained some insight into the state of public education today and what some of the steps we can take as parents and concerned citizens to influence the course of public education. I'm Damon Thomas. I've been your host for this segment of Making Waves here on WSCA-LP, Portsmouth Community Radio. Thanks again for listening. See you next week.
I am a backseat driver from America. We drive to the left on Falls Road. The man at the wheel's name is Seamus. We pass a child on the corner, he knows. And Seamus says, "No, what chance is that kid got?" And I say from the back, "I don't know." He says, "There's barbed wire at all of these exits, and there ain't no place in Belfast for that kid to go. It's a hard life. Very hard life. It's a hard life wherever you go. And if we poison our children with hatred, then the hard life is all that they'll know. And there ain't no place in Belfast for that kid to go. Cafeteria line in Chicago. They'll think that white hood's all they need. It's a hard life, it's a hard life, it's a very hard life, it's a hard life wherever you go. And if we poison our children with hatred, then the hard life is all that they'll know. And there ain't no place in Chicago for those kids to go. Could be held through TV with Disney and Cronkite and Martin Luther. And I believed, I believed, I believed. Now I am the backseat driver from America, and I am not at the wheel of control. And I am guilty, I am war, and I am the root of all evil, Lord, and I can't drive on the left side of the road. Cause it's a hard life, it's a hard life, it's a very hard life, it's a hard life wherever you go. And if we poison our children with hatred, then the hard life is all that they'll know. And there ain't no place in this world for these kids to go. Hard life forever you go.
That was Nancy Griffith with It's a Hard Life Wherever You Go. Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome your participation, too. Contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Also, please remember, WSCA is new, almost a year old, and growing, and hoping for your membership and participation. To join and learn more, go to www.wscafm.org. Next Saturday, there will be no Making Waves show. Instead, WSCA will be broadcasting live the one-year anniversary block party here in Portsmouth. Tune in the following week, September 17th, from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program, where we'll be focusing on the effects of the Iraq War on the Iraqis. We leave you now with this quote. The world that we have made as a result of the level of thinking that we have done so far has created problems we cannot solve at the level of thinking at which we created them. By Albert Einstein.